Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Small Business Digest Radio. My name is Don Mazzella, and I am your host for a program devoted to identifying strategies and suggestions to help small business managers increase profits, add sales, better manage cash flow, improve employee management, and streamline operations. Our guests are other entrepreneurs and experts offering their solutions to the problems and opportunities facing small business leaders. Our aim in each program is to provide one or two thought-provoking ideas or suggestions. So follow us on Twitter at #2SBDigest or at our website at www.smallbusinessdigest.net.
You know, I'm really looking forward to tonight's program. We've invited Art Soriano, CEO of the TSI company. He lives his office near our base in New Jersey. He's here to talk about training staff to be more effective in combining store and online marketing. And it's a topic that a lot of the people have written me about, and I was glad to get able to get them on the program. Art, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Don.
As we ask every guest, tell us a little bit about yourself, both personally and professionally, so before we get into the topic at hand.
Sure. Well, with me, both personally and professionally, it actually started out with music. I graduated college with a degree in music composition and started writing jingles early on, working for ad agencies, mostly in New York, and developing the skill of advertising to say as much as you can in as few words as possible and as quickly as you can. And it started to do very nicely. In fact, I wound up having my own ad agency for a few years, and then I had an opportunity to start to consult for various media companies, radio and television, and then from there, I started the business I have now, which has been around for 22 years, the TSI company. We started out with a marketing message for in-store for retailers as far as how to talk to customers while they were shopping. And shortly as we got that off the ground and working with the retail executives, we saw that there was a greater need to train the employees because most of them were going part-time because of health insurance costs. And training employees during business hours was a challenge. So taking the idea of music and taking the idea of saying as little as possible or as much as you can in as few words as possible, we developed a training methodology that began to teach associates what they needed to know during the business hours, delivering training via headset, standing in front of merchandise, being able to learn about product features and so on. And that eventually evolved into a methodology that we now have, which is patented, and it's called L-Training. And then from training through the years, as the company continued to grow and technology expanded, we then got more involved in developing ways to communicate and train with technology. And then the last piece we put together was, of course, the internal marketing. So we had the marketing, the training, the technology, and communication. And that really helped us help businesses improve their sales by really having customers come in and being served better by the store employees, having a better atmosphere with messages going on in the store and music and everything kind of related the way that it should. So basically, we were able to really enhance the shopping experience.
So you're in effect saying that you look at the whole environment, the background, the music, the messages, and try to train the staff to be part of that and to, in the end, add sales. Did
Absolutely.
I hear you right?
Absolutely. When you walk into a store, if I look at a store, excuse me, I'm going to look at the floor. Is the floor clean? Is the store lit? Is music playing? Are the associates there easy to identify as far as wearing, you know, some kind of a uniform, name badges? Are they smiling? Are they greeting the customers? That's the first step. The second piece, then, is customer engagement. if I walk into a store and if I have a question, is there an associate there that's going to walk up to me and, you know, and maybe ask me if I need help with something or if I have a question for them and they can answer it and be able to make recommendations that are going to be what I want, you know, for what I'm looking to purchase, and maybe make some recommendations to add on to that sale so that I'm not just buying this one thing, but maybe something else that goes with it, and really recognize me, the customer, as someone really being special, someone that really has, you know, value for that business, thanking me for my purchase, inviting me back, and really making me feel good about being in that store. When that happens, then you really have achieved that ultimate customer experience, which is what I say all the time, and you're going to start to have a customer that's going to be consistent, that's going to be loyal to your business, and before you know it, your sales are going to go up and up and up.
Well, our audience is made up primarily of small business people, 59% of whom are either presidents and or owners. And, this is a constant kind of question that comes up when we go around. But what are the elements of creating such an atmosphere? I mean, what do you actually train them, and how do you reach them?
Well, we start at the beginning, okay? So let's take whether it's a restaurant, whether it's a store that's going to sell apparel, whether it's a service business that sells insurance. When you're talking about a small business, when you're talking about a large business, it starts with the person at the top. What is that person's vision? What does that person have as far as the objectives for their business? How do they want their customers to be treated? So it starts with that. Secondly, what advantages does this company have that makes them unique from their competitors? So if it's a restaurant, perhaps it's the recipes, the ambiance, the way the food is served, whatever it might be. If it's an apparel store, maybe it's the design, maybe it's the fashion, maybe it's the prices, whatever it is. But all those elements combined with the service piece, what's going to make my customers feel special? Once we really get an understanding of that, then we develop training modules that are going to communicate that to the employees. And we deliver them in ways that we argue that we want to create effective training, meaning the training that is really there to give them the skills they need to do their job, explain why we want them to do this, which is very, very important, and focus on the advantages of that business so that the employee understands what makes the company that they work for different, that therefore they can communicate to the customers. And then we roll the training out, and we want to cover everything from customer service to product training to whatever systems they have to learn, procedures, policies, etc. And we make sure that we keep reinforcing those key advantages of the business, that the culture is right. We make sure that we communicate everything properly, so we try to avoid disconnect, because if the owner of the company is thinking one thing, but the employees are doing something else, you're going to have great disconnect in your business. So we want to make sure that the communication is tight. We want to make sure that the marketing is aligned with whatever our messages is. And all these elements are really important parts of the training. So many businesses, they want to just teach a particular task. So they wrote a training program out to teach that one task, and it's fine. And for a short term, the trainees learn this task and they do it. But without really giving them the reasons why they have to do it this way and explaining to them what's important about that for their business and important for the customer, soon they go back to their old habits, and whatever you're trying to get them to do, they don't do very well.
Well, you know, you can walk into any shopping mall, and you can go from store to store to store and see different attitudes, different approaches. But I had an incident Sunday. We went into a very high fashion store, and my wife wanted to buy a particular garment, and the woman said, "Well, that's only available online." And the way she said it really impacted me, because she was obviously upset about it. And so I asked her, and I said, "Why?" She said, "Because a lot of people have come in wanting that garment, and we're not allowed to sell it." And that's not the first time I've seen that kind of disconnect. And what should she have done to make my wife happier about it? Because we had made a special trip just for that.
That is a challenge because, unfortunately, and I have this conversation with clients all the time, you know, they get very upset because they see all the business they lose to the Internet. And you wonder, well, why did that happen? Because they've driven the customer there. So in this case, maybe, I don't know the story now, obviously I'm not going to ask, but she probably would have had to maybe have spoken to her manager to see what possible what they could possibly offer your wife, because obviously you want to protect the business. Maybe she could have went to a terminal in the store and gone onto the website with your wife to see if they could find the merchandise and, if possible, get it shipped either to the store or to your home without any inconvenience. Those are some of the things, but unfortunately today a lot of businesses don't want to carry all the inventory, so they keep it online. But to me, I think there are two really bad statements that I hear in stores, and it's a problem. Like yourself, when you go into a store and you ask a question and the response is, well, you got to go online. That is so cold and just really a turnoff for a customer. And the line I hate even, maybe even more than that, is when I'm walking around in the store and trying to find something or trying to find someone, and the store employee turns to me and is walking by 90 miles an hour and turns and says, finding everything okay? And keeps walking. You know, and you say to yourself, well, wait a second. Shouldn't be asking me, like, if I need any help or anything like that, you know. But unfortunately, too many of these businesses have gotten away from real good customer service.
Well, let me ask you that question. We have people on it, and we have a feeling, my wife and I, that customer service really has deteriorated from what it was years ago. Do you find that to be the case?
Absolutely. I have an equation that I try to explain to business people, and it basically is this, that customer service plus customer satisfaction equals customer experience, and they are very different. It starts with service. When I walk into a business, I want to be, you know, appreciated. So it's nice when an employee turns and says, good morning, or hi, or how are you today? And that's part of the service piece. But how they say it, how they deliver it, is going to be determined on whether I was satisfied with that. When an employee is walking by me 90 miles an hour and just turns and says, finally, I'm okay, and keeps walking, well, yeah, okay, I got a greeting, that's service, but I wasn't satisfied, so there wasn't any satisfaction. And if I want to have a really good experience, well, then if I'm really satisfied by what was said, and then the employee takes it one step further, maybe they said, good morning, how are you today? You know, can I help with something? And in turn, it says, gee, I really like your sweater, whatever the case might be, and helps you really build a sale. I'm going to achieve that customer experience, and that's the thing that I'm going to remember, that I was in this store, and the person really took great care of me. His name was David, or whatever the case was, really helped me out with this issue. Now I have a memory, and that's the experience. And that's the part where so many business people today, they just lost sight of that. They think as long as an employee walking around saying, find everything okay or hi and keep going is customer service, and it's not. And businesses, I know you have a lot of small business clients, but the big businesses have gotten so big that they've lost sight of the customer. Now, the good news is for the small business, that's their advantage. Because as a small business, if I'm a single store owner or a single restaurant owner or service business like that, I have a greater opportunity to really satisfy my customers and give them a good customer experience because I'm more involved in the day-to-day operations of my business. Depending on the size of my small business, I might be dealing with customers directly, and then that gives me the opportunity to really wow them and establish loyalty with them and ultimately build my business with greater sales and profits.
Well, then let's go really fast because that's our audience. How did the small business owner do that? What are some of the tricks that you've learned, perhaps strategies that you've learned that makes that possible?
Okay, starting with the basics, the rule we tell everybody, I don't care what size your business is, but the rule we tell everyone is there is no one or nothing. more important than the customer. If you agree with that, then everything else becomes easy. Now, there's that old, the old adage, the customer is always right. Okay, that's maybe, may not be true. But if you show your customer that you appreciate their business, if you show the customer that you really value their business, that they're really an important person for you, that there is no one or nothing more important than the customer, you're off to a good start. So I'll give you some examples. So maybe it's a small business home center, and the owner of the business is in the store, and a customer walks in. Well, whatever you're doing, stop doing and turn to the customer and greet that customer. Don't keep unloading that that shelf or, you know, unloading those boxes, whatever the case might be. Recognize that customer. Let that customer know that he or she is being valued and appreciated, and take care of those customers' needs. Go the extra mile if you have to get that customer what he or she needs. It doesn't mean that you always have to, like, bend over and, you know, lower your prices to a point where you're not going to make any profit, but show that customer appreciation. In my book, I talk about a small kind of an appliance store that I had done business with years ago, and how they just went out of their way to take care of me as a customer. And as a result, they wound up getting so much business from me for about 10 or 15 years when I lived in the area. I brought family and friends for the same reason, because of the customer service. So as a small business owner, think of what can you do that's going to really wow your customers. What advantages do you have about your business to make them purchase from you, and make sure that you make the customer aware of that each and every time. Stay in touch with your customers. After the sale is made, whatever it is, reach out to them a few days later, a week or so later. Make sure they're happy with their purchase. Make sure that there's anything else that they might need from you that you can, you know, get for them as another opportunity to make a sale. And keep that extension. You know, keep staying in touch with your customers and ask them for referrals, and, you know, help your business grow that way by networking through your customers.
Well, those are good thoughts. I just have to say, one of the first about greeting your customer, nothing infuriates me more than when I walk in the store and somebody's doing something and then makes me wait without acknowledging that I'm there until they finish that task. It's really, really interesting.
Yeah, and the businesses today, because, you know, there are so many different components to making a business successful, they've gotten so task-oriented. And depending on the size of the company, if it's, you know, especially if it's a multi-chain with, you know, several hundred locations or whatever, so much pressure to get these tasks done that, yes, they've lost sight of the customer. But that goes back to what I said earlier, where that becomes the advantage of the small business. Because in most cases in the small business, the owner is still involved, usually in a day-to-day, and he or she can prevent that from happening, and making sure that their employees don't let that happen. The customer has to be recognized. The customer has to come first. And when the customer does, you're going to win every time. You're going to make more sales. You're going to get more repeat business. You're going to get more referrals, and you're going to grow your business, and you'll be very, very happy with your results.
Well, you mentioned an appliance store, and since we're both from the same area, there was such an appliance store in Teaneck that I did business with for 10 or 15 years until they unfortunately went out of business. Mm-hmm. And I always felt that they really tried to find a solution for me and really followed up. I kind of miss the old-time appliance stores. I'm old enough to remember when television first came in and how it was a family event to go buy a television. Anyway, remember that. If you were, I'm a small business owner. If what are the two or three things? I know you said them kind of, but first off, what's the name of your book?
The book is called The Ultimate Customer Experience, and the subtitle is The Path to Victory for Any Business, Any Size, Any Time.
Well, you hit the nail on the head with that. I'll point out, and I'll ask you a question, since we are relatively. There are two Macy's near us. One of them, the Garden State Park, what the state?
Plaza, right.
And the other in, I forget the name of the other one. And the difference between the, I'm sorry?
Paramus Park.
Paramus Park, correct.
Right.
The difference between the customer experience in those two stores is amazing. They're less than 3 miles apart, but they're mild and different. And one of the questions, we think it's maybe because it's a totally different clientele at one versus the other. But would you want to comment on that? I mean, sometimes the clientele affects the employees as well.
To a point, but you have two stores, two different sizes. You have two different store managers. Probably have the same district manager as far as because of the geography, but maybe not. And again, you know, a store that size, a store manager functions as the CEO of that store. And depending on whatever he or her believes is important, is going to trickle down to their employees. So the store that you feel has the better service, and I'm sure I know which one of the two it is, probably
the
has
Paramus.
A store manager. I'm sorry?
Yeah, Paramus Park.
Right. Probably has a store manager who believes more in treating the customers right and maybe a little bit less on all the other things that has to get done. The fact that it is a smaller store makes it a bit easier to manage, which, you know, sometimes, you know, problems that, you know, the businesses have, the bigger the store, the, you know, the more employees, everything else. But it's a cultural thing. You know, and that isn't just with Macy's. You can go to any chain store, whether it be a Staples, a Bed Bath Beyond, or whatever, and you can have a wonderful experience in one store and go into another store and then have the direct opposite. And that is a big, big, big problem with a lot of the businesses because of the inconsistency. They don't know how to be consistent from one store to another. So in the Macy's example that you give, I would say if you've got two managers in a room and ask them the same questions, you might get some very different answers about their attitude about some things as far as how they communicate to the employees, how they task out the jobs that the employees have to do, how they hold people accountable, the follow-up, and all that stuff.
Well, I certainly learned a lot of that one. That one's been vexing me for years. I love this program because I sometimes get answers to things that vex me. The name of your book again?
It's called The Ultimate Customer Experience, and the subtitle is The Path to Victory for Any Business, Any Size, Any Time. And the point being is that the book is full of all concepts as far as how to really achieve that ultimate customer experience. And I define that basically as a customer that's come in to a business, whether it's a store, a restaurant, or a service business, who's not only happy during the time of purchase, but who leaves happy with a smile on his or her face, looking forward to coming back, telling family and friends that they too need to do business with that place. And the point of the book is that no matter what size your business is, whether it's one store, whether it's 1,000 stores, one restaurant, 1,000 restaurants, the principles still work because it's all about how do we make that customer really feel special? How do we wow that customer and therefore create that ultimate customer experience?
Well, Art, I'd like you to stay on. We have our next guest is here, and I'd like you just to come on. Phil Becknell is managing principal of Dinoff, Becknell, and Wells. They're an investigative group. And he's going to talk about background checks and proving burdensome. But I'd just love for you to stay on, if you wouldn't mind.
Sure.
And if
I
you
appreciate
contribute,
that. Mm-hmm.
Contribute.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you. I'll definitely hang out. Sure.
Phil, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Well, you, as I say, you're the managing principal, and you're here to talk about background checks to prove burdensome to employers and prospective employees, And I think it's a wide open topic, and I'm so glad you could join us today. But we always ask our guests first to say a little bit about their personal background before we get into the subject. So,
sure.
Wouldn't mind telling us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So I've been an investigator in the private sector for about 15 years, and the last 10 years I've been the managing partner of Denault Becknell and Wells Investigative Group, which is a investigations firm based in Washington, D.C. So my firm was ranked last year as the best private investigations provider by the National Law Journal. We're a firm that specializes primarily in litigation support for attorneys, but as part of that, we do background checks routinely in those cases, and witnesses, and defendants. And we also do pretty comprehensive background checks for high-level individuals who are candidates for executive-level positions and the key players in companies that our clients are seeking to acquire and that kind of thing. So we're pretty involved in background checks in many different areas.
Well, having said that, you're saying without guidance, there may be some problems. What do you mean by that?
When I say, I'm sorry, without guidance, there may be some problems?
Well, that's how I interpret it. Employer and prospective employees without guidance or financial incentive could be burdensome. What do you mean by that?
Oh, I see. Well, I mean, when you're evaluating anybody, I mean, the only benchmark that's really reliable, that's proven to be reliable time and again, is looking at their past behavior and what they've done in the past. I think a lot of times employers and others sort of shoot from the hip. They meet somebody, they look them in the eye, and they say, I can trust this guy. And, you know, unfortunately, without knowing more about that person and things they might have done in the past, you're really, you know, there's a bias that takes place during that interaction where you could miss a whole lot. And you can hire people who end up stealing from you and doing a bunch of bad things that can damage your business.
You know, well, time after time we see in the newspaper, and I've reported them, where really bad people keep getting hired. Is that because there's not a people haven't done their real due diligence?
In a lot of cases, it is. I mean, you know, there's a lot of companies that don't routinely do background checks, and that's certainly a problem, particularly when you have positions of where you're trusting the person with your financials and your cash. And, you know, I think that there's certainly certain levels of it. I mean, I'm not saying that you have to do background checks on every single person necessarily, but certainly if the person has the power to do harm, you know, then it's certainly something you'd want to consider.
Well, our audience is primarily small businesses. So if I hear you correctly, you're talking really about the senior level positions where they're handling money or handling other sensitive material. Am I right?
I mean, again, it depends on the position. I mean, I think that if you have somebody who is stocking shelves, I mean, certainly there's the potential for that person to, you know, walk away with a TV set. But I think that in the grand scheme of things, that the risk of that might be, I mean, what does a TV set cost? And I guess it depends. But, you know, a few hundred bucks, well, it costs a few hundred dollars for a background check. And so I think in that instance, you know, it might not be worthwhile to spend a lot of money vetting that person, because really the damage they can do isn't that great, all considered. But I think if you're hiring an accountant for your small business, or you're hiring somebody who is going to have some degree of administrative access to your accounting program, or then the damage that they can do is much greater. I mean, we're talking tens, hundreds of thousands of dollars. And in that case, spending $500 on a background check is definitely worth the cost. So I think you just have to look at the position. You have to look at the position and determine in that instance whether it's worthwhile to do or not. But certainly,
well,
go ahead.
No, you first.
I was going to say, just to repeat basically what I said, that certainly if there's a potential for the person to do significant damage, then it's generally worth the cost.
Well, I come to you, I'm a small business about to hire my VP of finance. What do you ask of us, and what we should we be asking of you?
So background checks for employment purposes are governed by the Fair Credit Reporting Act, which means that you have to notify the employee that you're doing a background check for them, and you need to get their consent. So the first thing I'd ask you if you came to me and wanted a background check is, do you have a release signed by the person that gives us authority to do the background check? And so once you have that, then it's just a question of doing the investigation. There's certain other things that some people look at and some people don't look at. Credit reports, for example. I mean, you could, if the position is a financial position, a lot of companies will also have us run credit reports on people. But we don't. If it's not a financial position or doesn't relate to money in any way, then you can't. You don't have a permissible purpose to access the credit report. Some companies are now having us look at social media, and also having us do the reference checks and things like that. Sometimes companies like to do the reference checks themselves. So every background check is a little different. But the bottom line is, once we have permission and we understand what the scope of what the company is looking for, we do the investigation within that scope.
And then that I'm not
position.
I'm sorry, I stepped on you. Please finish.
It's okay. I was going to say that scope depends a lot on what the position is.
Well, there's been a lot of noise about saying people should not look for a criminal background check until the person has been given a job offer. I would think it would be better to know about a criminal background before I gave it a job offer, because in some states, once you get the offer, you're liable for it.
Yeah, I mean that's there's of course the danger of doing background checks controlled way has the risk of discriminating against people based on their history. And I guess there's ways to do it. There's the right way to do a background check and there's the wrong way to do a background check. And the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission and the FCRA provide guidance to employers about how the best way to do that is. And so some of the guidance suggests that you can disqualify somebody on the basis of a background check report, but that is supposed to be explicit in the process. So it's like you're not supposed to. You have 10 candidates, you do background checks on them, and you decide based on in part on the background check which ones to disqualify. They say that you shouldn't do that because you're comparing them against each other and not against their qualifications. So just because somebody has a criminal conviction, for example, they might be the best qualified person otherwise. And so you're supposed to sort of pretend like you don't know that information, I guess, and then base the offer for employment on that. And then once the background check's done and you know of the conviction, that can be a disqualifying factor. But at that point, you're required under the FCRA to notify the employee and to provide them a copy of the investigative report that states the reason for why they were disqualified. And the idea is, again, that it prevents you from it basically makes you state explicitly why what the issue was that caused you not to hire the person.
Well, I'm a small employee. I have 7 employees. I'm about to hire another one, and you tell me that he has a criminal record, and I just don't want a criminal inside my small organization.
Mm-hmm.
The, and I don't follow your guidelines, but I find it out in doing the reference. For instance, if I did a reference check, and in the course of it, someone says, you know, he was jailed for stealing and went to jail for 2 years, and that's how you found out. Is that, and am I then enabled to say, I just don't want a criminal in my company?
You are, but you, if they then asked you, why did you decide not to hire me, you would be required, provided there was a document that had that information on it. Like, for example, if you did the reference check, you took notes, you generated some kind of document from that, that would be what the FCRA refers to as an investigative consumer report, because it contains information about the subject of the investigation. And so under the FCRA, the employee would be privy to that report. Actually, let me qualify this for a second. If you do that as a small business owner, I'm sorry, the FCRA does not apply, but if you hire a third party to do it, then it applies. So actually, in your example, it would not be a consumer report because you're doing the investigation yourself. So it's kind of,
so
it applies to third party investigators and people who do background checks. It doesn't apply to people who are end users of the information. So for example, because you're the owner of the company, you have a little bit more leeway as far as what qualifies as a consumer report.
Oh. Yeah, you know, it's really fascinating. I've hired ex-cons, and I've not hired ex-cons. It's really based on the individual. But I found, and I'm going to turn back to Art for 1 minute on this one. But I found that when I've hired someone who has a criminal background, the other employees got very upset about it, and I'd like to bring Art back in and say, have you ever run into that, and how do you deal with that?
I haven't run into it personally, but there's a couple ways you could handle it. One would be to, before you hire the person, if it's a small company, you might want to speak with your employees first and explain your reasons why you want to hire the person. Depends what the criminal background is. You know, they may have done something minor, made a mistake at one point, and, you know, it was a long time ago, whatever. And it's important to share with the other employees, you know, what your thoughts are and why you'd like to bring this person on, and kind of make them feel comfortable and part of the decision, because you're at least hearing their input and their feedback. And then conversely, if they really gave you some valid reasons as to why you might not want to hire that employee, then that might be good for you to know, because what you don't want to do is bring someone in that's going to then cause a problem with the other employees that you have, because that's not going to be good for your business.
Phil, are small employees exempt from these regulations, or does it apply to everybody?
No, it applies to everybody. It applies to any time that you're using Well, the FCRA applies anytime you're using a third-party vendor to do background checks on employees.
We had individuals on last year who does foreign credential verification, and it all came about because of a company sponsored an individual to come into the country, only to find out that every one of his degrees that he claimed were false. Do you do those type of things as well?
We do those as well. We do education credential checks and basically everything under the sun involving people's backgrounds.
Well, have you? There have been several reports that credential have been grossly exaggerated. In fact, a couple of CEOs have lost their jobs because of what they claimed in terms of academic credentials were wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Are you seeing a trend in this?
I mean, I've seen that pretty consistently since I've started doing this business. I think that what could be happening, I guess, it could be that it's coming to light more often now because it's become easier to check information online than it used to be 10 years ago. So I think that nowadays, you know, if you're going to claim that you graduated from such and such university, I mean, it's relatively easy to go to that university or whoever houses that university's record, and usually you can check to see if there's a degree there relatively easily. Whereas before, you might have had to call the registrar of the university and send them a letter and a release, and it was much more time-consuming and difficult to do it. So because the process is somewhat more automated now than it was before, I think it's likely just that people are being caught more readily. But I don't know if the falsification has necessarily increased. In my experience, it's always been there. There's always been people who we found falsifying different aspects of their backgrounds.
Are you there?
I'm here, but I didn't hear the last thing you said. I got got garbled there for a minute.
No. I'm sorry. Sometimes happen. Basically, business.
I hate to tell you this, but I can't hear really anything.
Okay. Do you hear me now?
I can hear you now, yeah.
Art, do you hear me?
Yes.
Phil, do you hear me?
I can hear you now very well.
Okay. We lost you there for a minute, Tom, but you're back, so you're fine.
Well, I'm on the road as well. And sometimes that happens. I'm back in my studio next week. I'd kind of like to sum up and ask you, Phil, what would you like to tell our audience about this, and what they should really look out for?
Background checks, doing background checks on employees is an area that's pretty fraught with potential pitfalls in terms of litigation, in terms of inadvertently discriminating against people. It might not be what you intend. And I think that it's a process that's best done in a way when you know what the pitfalls are and you do it in a systematic way that's fair to people and that works the best for your business. I mean, I think you do background checks on the people that are in trust positions. I think you do it in such a way, that obviously you're not looking at things that shouldn't matter. I mean, you should obviously consider the person's qualifications, and that you might want to consider using a third party, although it does trigger other legal requirements. Using a third party helps protect you from knowing information about somebody that might not be relevant to the hiring decision. I mean, it's very common for us to get people who scour people's social media sites, for example, and then decide not to hire the person for some reason, ostensibly for a criminal conviction, for example, or something else. But when you're looking at that much information, there's a whole bunch of stuff that you now know about that person: their race, their sexual orientation, their other things that could trigger a potential lawsuit. And so it's best to do it, in a way where you're protecting yourself, and that's often done, in my opinion, best by using a third party to do it for you.
Well, you brought up social media, and people are saying now that you shouldn't hang it all out on your social media sites because it comes back to haunt you. Are you seeing that happening?
Oh, definitely, yeah. People do let it hang out, and that's one of the first things in my experience that hiring managers do. I mean, you get a resume and you go, "Who is this person?" You know, and that's sure. I've had cases where people have talked openly about drug use and criminal activity and things like that, and that's that obviously doesn't end very well for them. So now, yeah, you definitely, from the perspective of an employee or a prospective employee, you want to lock down your accounts and be careful about what you talk about, for sure.
Well, can you turn down someone because of prior drug use?
You can. You know, it depends. So, I mean, there's rules regarding, and every state's different about how long a criminal conviction can be considered. So there's some states that prevent you from considering criminal convictions if they're older than, say, 10 years or 8 years. Drug activity, there's not a lot of guidance on that. So I mean, if the drug history is pretty old, I think that you might have a problem. But I think if somebody is talking openly about doing drugs in the relatively recent past, I think that you'd be pretty safe as an employer using that as a disqualifier.
It's interesting. We have a relative in the family who went through rehab and is now a teacher, and he went through a case where the school district said, if we had known you were a former drug user, we would never have hired you. And it's into litigation. I've often wondered about that. Phil, the name of your company and how people can reach you?
Sure. My company is called Denault. That's D-I-N-O-L-T, Becknell, which is B-E-C-N-E-L, and Wells Investigative Group. And we're online at www.denault. That, once again, that's D-I-N-O-L-T.com.
Well, I'd like to go back to Art for a minute or two. And I'd like, Art, for you to say some of the things you said earlier, so, and how people can reach you and your get your book. But what would be the three things you would say to a small business that's really trying to do reach a high customer satisfaction level?
Number one, what makes your business unique? What's different about your business? What advantages that you have? That's important. Number two, when you are engaging the customer, what can I do to really make that customer feel special? What can I really make that customer remember me by as far as doing business? And number three, how can I stay in touch with that customer after that purchase has taken place, whether it be through social media, whether it be through, mailers, phone calls, whatever, and just those three things together will really help a business can really, I think, improve and hit that wow factor with a customer.
And the name of your book again?
Name of the book is The Ultimate Customer Experience, The Path to Victory for Any Business, Any Size, Any Time.
Well, I hope you'll send me a copy. I've got to figure out how to make my guests more comfortable.
Sure. And if anybody wants to reach me through my company, it's the TSI company. We're in New Jersey. And our website is www.thetsicompany.com. Or if they want to call, it's 201-833-8400.
Phil, what's your company's phone number?
It's 202-638-5000.
Really appreciate both of you coming on tonight. I know I learned a heck of a lot, and I hope our audience did as well. And I hope you both of you will come back sometime in the future and talk more.
Sure, definitely. I'd love to. Thanks so much.
Well, really, have a great day.
Thank you so much. Have a good night.
Thank
nice to talk to you, Phil,
tonight.
As well.
All of our guests are invited because they offer actionable advice to our audience. They do not pay to join us, but rather demonstrate their capacity for helping our audience and profits. Thank you for listening, and we'll be here again next week with other experts to talk about ways to improve your profit picture. Remember, we're here every week at blogtalkradio.com/smallbusinessdigest. If you like what you heard today, tell others about our efforts. If you would like to be a guest or suggest topics for future hours, email me at info@smallbusinessdigest.net. That's info@smallbusinessdigest.net.